A Princess of Mars cover to cover in 1974. He picked up the Lensman books by E.E. Doc Smith, featuring a race of interstellar superhuman policemen. The Lensmen travel the galaxy, finding particularly smart individuals to join them via the Lens, a mysterious crystal that tunes into the life force and turns its wearers into mind-reading telepaths. Lucas seems to have turned influences over in his brain, as if he were tossing a salad. The Star Wars is a mixture of Lawrence of Arabia, the James Bond films, and 2001, he told the Swedish film magazine Chaplin in the fall of 1973, which oddly enough appears to be his first published interview about the movie in any language. The space aliens are the heroes, and Homo sapiens naturally the villains. Nobody has done anything like this since Flash Gordon conquers the universe. The Homo sapiens line wasn't strictly true of any draft he finished, but it did show the breadth of possibilities he was playing with. He also managed to come up with one more dramatic metaphor for the movie-making process. "It's like mountaineering," he told the Swedish reporter. "It's freezing cold, you lose your toes, but then you reach the top, and it's worth it." In May 1974, Lucas turned 30, the age by which he had promised his father he'd be a millionaire. He had achieved that goal many times over. He had also summited First Draft Mountain, and it was quite a height he'd scaled. The first complete draft of The Star Wars stood 191 scenes and 33,000 words tall. In movies of the early 1970s, the average scene lasted 2 minutes. Even if Lucas was planning on making his scenes a minute each on average, a tall order given the weight of dialogue, The Star Wars would last 3 hours and 10 minutes. Nevertheless, Lucas made 4 copies and sent them to Coppola, Robbins, Barwood, and Willard Hike, who, along with his wife, Gloria Katz, had provided that essential humorous rewrite in American Graffiti's 4th draft. None of these early readers would give the Star Wars script rave reviews. Like the Hidden Fortress-inspired 10-page treatment, the first draft was overflowing with plot, albeit an entirely different plot. It had moved in the right direction in some respects. No longer was this taking place in the 33rd century, but in some nameless time. And the eternal conflict of Jedi against Sith, the fall of the Jedi, and the rise of the Empire, which underpinned the whole story of 6 Star Wars movies, was mentioned at the very beginning. In a Flash Gordon-style roll-up, the opening crawl, we learn that the Jedi Bendu were the Emperor's personal bodyguards and chief architects of the Imperial Space Force. Then a rival warrior sect, the Knights of Sith, hunted down and killed them for the new Empire. We cut to a moon where an 18-year-old called Anakin Starkiller sees a spacecraft zoom overhead and then rushes into a rocket ship to alert his father, Kane, and 10-year-old brother, Deke, who has been tasked with a philosophy problem. That's right. The first script of the Star Wars opens not with explosions and droids and Darth Vader, but with homework. Anakin. "Dad, Dad! They found us!" Deke looks up from a small cube he has been studying. His father whacks him across the shoulder with a braided wire connector. Kane. "Continue with the problem. Your concentration is worse than your brother's." To Anakin. "How many?" Anakin. "Only one this time. A Banta 4. Kane. "Good. We may not have to repair this old bucket after all. Prepare yourself." Deke. "Me too." Kane. "Do you have the answer?" Deke. "I think it's the Corbett dictum. What is without." Kane smiles. This is the correct answer. Deke is promptly killed by a 7-foot Sith knight and his character forgotten. If the sprawling script has a protagonist, it is probably Anakin Starkiller. Kane takes him back to their home planet of Aqualai, now threatened with Imperial invasion. He asks his old friend, General Luke Skywalker, to train Anakin as a Jedi, while Kane visits another old friend, a green-skinned alien called Han Solo. Aqualai's leader, the improbably named King Chaos, squabbles with his senators about whether the Empire actually plans to invade. Chaos sends them off with a blessing. "May the force of others be with you all." To General Skywalker, a few scenes later, he says, "I feel the force also." The force goes unmentioned and unexplained for the rest of the script. The concept Lucas first explored in the writing of THX was almost as hesitant to break out into his writing now as it was in his first screenplay 4 years earlier. Anakin has a tryst in a closet with a female aide. General Skywalker is so angered by this that he and Anakin lock laser swords. The spelling of this weapon would keep changing between drafts. It would only become lightsaber in the fourth draft. But there's no time for dueling. A giant space fortress is on the way. Anakin jumps in a land speeder to save the king's daughter, Princess Leia, just before the planet is struck by two atomic explosions. Pilots attack the space fortress in retaliation. "There's too much action, Chewie," one pilot tells another. The readers tended to agree. Halfway through the script, we cut to the space fortress and a couple of construction robots, R2-D2, a claw-armed tripod, and C-3PO, who boasts a totally metallic surface of an Art Deco design. In other words, the Metropolis robot. Notable about their dialogue, it is dialogue. R2 talks. R2, "You're a mindless, useless philosopher. Come on, let's go back to work. The system is all right." 3PO, "You overweight glob of grease, quit following me. Get away, get away." Another explosion, and the robots cling to each other in terror. They find an escape pod and head for the planet below, where Anakin and Princess Leia encounter them. R2 is shocked into speechlessness. Darth Vader, a human Imperial general, lands on Aqualai, preparing the way for Valorum, a Knight of the Sith. Luke and Anakin go to the spaceport of Gordon, where they have that laser sword brawl in a cantina. They meet Han Solo, who takes them to Kane. Kane powers Han's ship by ripping a power pack out of his own cyborg chest, killing himself. Pursued by the Empire, the ship hides in an asteroid belt and makes an emergency landing on the forest world of Yavin. Here, they encounter giant Wookiees, led by Chewbacca. No, not the same Chewie as the pilot in the earlier scene. The princess is captured and taken to the space fortress. Anakin sneaks aboard but is captured and tortured by Darth Vader. Watching this, Valorum decides to switch sides and save Anakin and Leia. The trio tumble into a garbage chute where they are almost crushed, but they manage to escape just before the Wookiees, trained by General Skywalker, destroy the fortress in one-man fighters. Leia returns to Aqualai, is crowned queen, and names Anakin Lord Protector. Confused, lost, overwhelmed, you're not the only one. "It was a universe nobody could understand from the scripts," said Hike. "Not until George acted it out. But when he did, his enthusiasm for the scene helped him communicate it. Lucas can easily paint pictures with words, by all accounts, but only when he's speaking them." Lucas leaned heavily on Hike and Katz during the early stages of the drafting process. Every time he went down to L.A., he paid a visit to the couple, showed them the draft in progress, and left with notes on what to fix. For the version he sent to Laddie at 20th Century Fox a few months later, he changed a bunch of names, again, from our perspective, moving in the wrong direction. Anakin Starkiller became Justin Valor. The Jedi, shockingly, became the Dianoga. The horror of writing a second draft seemed almost too much to bear. Lucas had been getting stomach pains from the tension of writing. "You beat your head against the wall and say, 'Why can't I make this work?'" he recalled a decade later. "Why aren't I smarter? Why can't I do what everybody else can do?" In March 1974, he had told Filmmakers Newsletter that he would hire somebody to do a rewrite. Hal Barwood remembers Lucas, on one of his trips to L.A. post-graffiti, trying to persuade him to write a draft. "George approached me in an oblique way to see if I might be a collaborator on writing Star Wars," he says. Barwood is bashful about it now. "I would have been the wrong guy to write a movie like this," he says. "I'm interested in science fiction rather than space opera, so it would have been a big problem for me. I didn't realize how much of a taste I had for adventurous movie making. I was very interested in much more arty stuff. And I was a huge fan of Star Trek." So Lucas dragged himself back to the door desks for another round. Kurtz's secretary, Bunny Alsop, remembered him getting so miserable over the script that he would tear his hair out, cutting one unruly curl at a time, filling a wastebasket with them. "You go crazy writing," Lucas said decades later. "You get psychotic. You get yourself so psyched up and go in such strange directions in your mind that it's a wonder all writers aren't put away someplace. You can just get so convoluted in what you're thinking about that you get depressed, unbearably depressed, because there's no guideline. You don't know if what you're doing is good or bad or indifferent. It always seems bad when you're doing it. It seems terrible. It's the hardest thing to get through." In January 1975, the second draft was ready. Now titled Adventures of the Star Killer, Episode 1, The Star Wars, it was about 5,000 words lighter than its predecessor. Lucas wrapped it in a gold-embossed folder, as if to emphasize how seriously he was taking it. The first thing any reader who was paying attention would have noticed about the second draft, the Journal of the Wills is back. The movie opens with a Bible-like prophecy, supposedly taken from its pages. "And in the time of greatest despair, there shall come a savior, and he shall be known as the Son of the Sons." The golden bough seems to have sunk in because religious statements and the religion of the Force are front and center this time. In the roll-up, we read that the Jedi Bendu learned the ways of the mysterious Force of Others until they were eradicated when the Empire took over. But there's one Jedi out there still fighting the good fight, known only as the Starkiller. The roll-up may be more ponderous than its predecessor, but the opening scene is far more action-driven. A small rebel space fighter is being chased by not one, but four giant Imperial Star Destroyers. The rebel ship returns fire and destroys one of them. We cut to the droids, now rendered as R2 and 3PO, aboard the smaller ship. They are now on the side of the rebels. R2 makes a series of electronic sounds that only a robot could understand. The placement of these droids lends credence to an otherwise dubious story that Lucas tells about the creation of the Star Wars trilogies. Ever since 1979, 2 years after the first movie's release, Lucas has attempted to convince us that his writing process was some variation on the following: taking the first draft of Star Wars, cutting it in half, choosing the second half, then chopping the resulting story into three parts, which became the original trilogy. But it's a dubious claim once you read the first three drafts, which are three completely different stories, containing some similar scenes in roughly the same position. "That's not true," Kurtz says bluntly of Lucas's assertion. "There were lots of little bits and pieces that were reasonably good ideas and ended up in the final draft. After which, there wasn't enough material to do other movies." He admits that both he and Lucas gave post-Star Wars interviews in which they talked about the movie being a section out of the middle of a larger story, but that this was in the fictional Journal of the Wills sense of a larger story. "It's very easy in hindsight to make things a lot simpler than they actually were," Kurtz adds. If there is any evidence for Lucas's halves and thirds anecdote, it is this. The droids who showed up halfway through the first draft are now at the beginning of the second. R2 and 3PO's ship is boarded by stormtroopers, the first real appearance of the space soldiers in any draft thus far. Their still very human leader is General Darth Vader, still just Sith Knight Valorum's right-hand man. Deke, one of the sons of the Starkiller, makes short work of the stormtroopers. Deke, a Jedi, uses a blaster, while the stormtroopers wield laser swords. Vader defeats Deke because he is strong with the Bogan, Lucas's initial name for the dark side of the Force. The droids escape to the desert planet below, where R2 is instructed to make contact with one Owen Lars. 3PO tags along only because his prime directive is survival. When Lucas imagined 3PO talking, he heard a public relations guy or a sleazy used car dealer, perhaps like the one Universal cut from American Graffiti. The droids are captured by hooded, robot-nabbing dwarves, sometimes called Jawas. Coincidentally, Lucas's friend Steven Spielberg was about to make a movie based on the novel Jaws. Lucas had spent some time down in L.A. to see the faulty mechanical shark close up and gotten briefly stuck in its giant gray maw. There's a robot revolt inside the Jawa's wagon. The robots escape, much like the Hidden Fortress peasants. Arriving at a small moisture ranch, they find Lars, his nephew Biggs and Windy, his niece Leia, and our hero, 18-year-old Luke Starkiller. Lucas had lost interest in writing about a gruff old general. He preferred Luke as a young hero, son of the Starkiller, brother of the recently defeated Deke, himself a Jedi trained by his Uncle Owen. We find him in the desert at laser sword practice, fending off blasts from a floating chrome baseball. Luke is now a sensitive artist type, a historian who would much rather catalog the ancients than fight in a galactic war. "I'm not a warrior," he says. So why was he practicing? R2 plays a hologram of Deke, informing Luke the enemy has constructed a powerful weapon to use against their father. We know not what, and Luke must take the Kyber crystal to him on Organa Major. After a dinner of Thanta sauce and bum-bum extract, Luke embarks on a long-winded, jargon-filled explanation to his younger brothers about the Force of Others. Originally discovered by a holy man called the Skywalker, the Force is divided into the good half, Ashla, and the Paraforce called the Bogan. To prevent people with less strength from discovering the Bogan, the Skywalker only taught it to his children, who passed it on to theirs. And there you have it. As conceived for the first time, the Force was an exclusive aristocratic cult. Luke isn't done. Like a boring uncle at a family dinner, he drones on and on about politics, how the Senate grew too large, fell under the control of the power and transport guilds, and then secretly instigated race wars and aided anti-government terrorists, with the aid of a Bogan-influenced Jedi called Darklighter, who turned a bunch of pirates into Sith Knights. The next morning, Luke and the droids head off to Mos Eisley and its cantina. There he meets Han Solo, now a burly, bearded, but ruggedly handsome boy dressed in a gaudy array of flamboyant apparel. Coppola, basically. Han hangs out with an 8-foot gray bush baby monkey with baboon-like fangs, Chewbacca, here wearing cloth shorts, and a science officer called Montross. The bar brawl plays out. Luke and his laser sword win handily. Han leads him to his ship via a stop for a steaming bowl of boma mush. There's a lot of food in this draft, and demands an even million for passage to Organa Major. Luke sells his speeder as a down payment. His father, the Starkiller, will pay the rest. The moment where a Jawa fawns over the speeder to 3PO's horror, "Nice zoom zoom," offers the funniest line in this difficult draft. Solo turns out to be a cabin boy who's talking a big game. His unnamed ship is owned by a bunch of pirates, one called Jabba the Hutt. The pirates are addled by spice, which here appears to be simply an addictive recreational drug in the style of THX's pills, rather than the mysterious life-extending chemical found in Dune. This allows Solo to create a diversion, steal the ship, and take his passengers to Organa Major. The planet has been destroyed. They don't know what by. So they head to the planet of Alderaan, to a city in the clouds, much like the Hawkmen city in Flash Gordon, where Deke is held prisoner. They free him by dressing up as stormtroopers, using Chewbacca as their prisoner. As they start blasting their way out, Han is overcome by a mysterious attack of depression. Han: "It's no use. We're lost." Luke: "No, no, there's a debris chute. It's the Bogan Force making you feel that way. Don't give up hope. Fight it." Han: "It's no use. It's no use." Luke: "Well, we're going anyway. Think of good things. Drive the Bogan from your mind." It's astonishing how much the word Bogan crops up in this draft. 31 times in total, versus 10 mentions for the light side Ashla Force. It's not hard to picture the depressed writer whiling away the long hours at his door desks, trying to drive the Bogan from his mind. Down the garbage chute go our heroes, into the belly of the beast, to do battle with a creature called a Dianoga, in a trash compactor that the droids are able to shut down before it crushes them. The gang escapes Alderaan in classic adventure serial style, taking a bunch of bad guys hostage. On the ship, it turns out Deke is badly injured. 3PO can't do anything for him. "These are spiritual wounds," he explains. "The Bogan arts often run contrary to the ways of science and logic." Also defying logic is Luke's sudden certainty that his father is on the fourth moon of Yavin, Yavin 4, out on the edge of the galaxy. On their way, they pass an enormous, mysterious something. "As big as a small moon," says Montross. On Yavin's fourth moon, Luke and Han find the Starkiller's allies, including the Grand Moff Tarkin, a thin, bird-like commander. The mysterious, approaching something is finally identified as the Death Star. More of a spiritual than a technological terror, it contains all the force of Bogan. But the Starkiller has seen a weakness, a small thermal exhaust port on the Death Star's north pole. Finally, we meet the Starkiller, a wizened old man with a long silver beard and shining gray-blue eyes whose aura of power almost knocks Tarkin over. Tarkin fears the Bogan is too strong and the Starkiller too old, that is, until Luke hands his dad the Kyber crystal, which seems to restore his vital essence. All the Starkiller says to his long-lost son, "There'll be time for full Jedi training later." Luke suits up and joins the attack on the Death Star. Han gets his reward, 8 million in neatly minted chrome bars. Of course, a car nut would create a galaxy where the currency is chrome. Strangely, there hasn't been a villain in the script for 2 hours. Not until Darth Vader, feeling the presence of the Ashla Force, leads a team of TIE fighters from the Death Star. He destroys all the rebel ships but Luke's before being destroyed himself by a returning Han. Vader crashes into Han's ship. Han and Chewie eject in a life pod. And who gets to fire the fatal shot that destroys the Death Star? Not Luke, but 3PO riding shotgun. Back on Yavin 4, the Starkiller offers his thanks. No medals here. And announces that the revolution has begun. Before the closing credits, we get a second roll-up. It promises a sequel. The Adventures of the Starkiller, Episode 2, The Princess of Andos, in which the Lars family will get kidnapped, the Sith will return, and the Starkiller's sons will be put through further trials. So much for chopping the first draft into halves and thirds. Even at this point in the drafting process, Lucas planned to enter uncharted territory with the sequel. Note that the name of that supposed sequel, and how readily Lucas seemed to abandon the Star Wars name for the franchise as a whole. He may have honestly preferred Adventures of the Starkiller, which does sound rather Flash Gordon-esque. But there may have been a different calculation at work here. Budget talks with Fox were deadlocked. Nobody had any idea how much a movie like this was supposed to cost. Lucas kept insisting this was the first multi-million dollar Flash Gordon kind of movie. Kurtz tried pricing it out, but admitted his figures were arbitrary. One of his budgets came to $6 million, another to $15 million. At one point, Fox's moribund visual effects department estimated that the effects shots alone would cost $7 million. That was definitely a finger in the wind time. However, there was progress in the garbage portion of the contract that would turn out to be crucial. Lucas got sequel rights, so long as he started producing one within 2 years of the movie's release. Then there was merchandising. Contrary to legend, the contract didn't give Lucasfilm exclusive rights to all movie-related products. Fox could sell those too. It was more of a marriage than a giveaway. But it did give Lucas's shell company complete control over the name. The Star Wars Corporation shall have sole and exclusive right to use the name The Star Wars in connection with wholesale or retail outlets for the sale of merchandising items. Given that the main title of this and subsequent movies in the second draft was now Adventures of the Starkiller, Lucas's control of the name The Star Wars might not have seemed a big deal to lawyers at the time. And, for all we know, that may well have been the point. If Lucas changed the name of the movie series for the purpose of contract negotiations, that would have been one of the most shrewd script switches in history. Lucas showed the second draft to his trusted coterie. He held Friday night barbecues, during which he brought Barwood, Robbins, and a rotating cast of friends back to his office to read chunks of the script and tape record their reactions. The second draft met with little more enthusiasm than the first. "Anyone who read those drafts said, 'What are you doing here? This is absolute gobbledygook,'" recalled Kurtz. Coppola, ever the cheerleader, couldn't understand why Lucas had chucked the first script and started again. But Barwood points out that Coppola always thought he was writing alone like Lucas, even though he invariably had assistants. With all due respect to Francis, he's never been able to figure out how to properly tell a story without a little help. Mario Puzo saved his butt. Still, even Barwood, the science fiction fan, had a hard time understanding Lucas's story. If he didn't get it, Fox would have no clue. Lucas needed visuals, fast. Luckily, he had decided to call that artist guy Barwood introduced him to. Lucas had commissioned Ralph McQuarrie in November 1974, before completing the second draft. McQuarrie finished his first Star Wars painting on January 2, 1975, the day after Lucas officially completed the draft script. Even though McQuarrie hadn't had a full script to work from, his earliest concept paintings would indelibly shape not just the first film, but the entire Star Wars saga. McQuarrie's painting showed the two characters people had the hardest time imagining, the droids, lost in the desert of Yutapau, an arid planet that would eventually be supplanted in the script by Tatooine. The name would have to wait 30 years to find its place in the saga. 3PO's humanoid eyes looked directly, pleadingly at the viewer. I asked Anthony Daniels whether he would have played 3PO without McQuarrie's painting to explain the character for him. "Absolutely, 100% not," he said. As guidance for R2, Lucas had mentioned the squat, slinky-legged, wheeled robots from Silent Running, Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Since they were square, McQuarrie decided to make R2 round. In one of many sketches, as a tripod, so McQuarrie imagined him as a tripod who throws his center leg forward by propping himself on his side legs, as if on crutches. For the second painting, completed the following month, McQuarrie tackled the laser sword duel between Deke Starkiller and Darth Vader. Lucas supplied McQuarrie with a book on Japanese medieval military culture, suggesting that Vader might wear a flared samurai-style helmet. He also provided pulp illustrations in which the villain wore a cape. But Lucas still imagined Vader as fully human, his face partially obscured by cloth, Bedouin style. McQuarrie spent just one day on the Vader painting. He considered that Vader had just entered from the vacuum of space, and so he gave him a full-face military-style gas mask. It was McQuarrie who created the instant emotional bond with 3PO that Daniels cannot shake to this day. Gas mask and black samurai helmet together, the effect was immediately stunning. Vader towers over young Deke, the perspective giving the impression he's supposed to be a Frankenstein-like giant. But this is, in fact, the most fortuitous misunderstanding in Star Wars history. McQuarrie, in fact, saw Vader as a short villain, a ratty little guy, in the words of Paul Bateman, an artist McQuarrie later collaborated with. His perspective decision in that one painting would later inspire Lucas to cast 6'5" bodybuilder Dave Prose in the role, making Vader one of the tallest villains in cinematic history. Within a couple of months, McQuarrie completed three more paintings. Now Lucas had visual aids to explain the Death Star, the Cloud City on Alderaan, and the Cantina sequence. In the last, a stormtrooper was seen in his fascist white uniform for the first time. Luke Starkiller had not yet been visualized, but it was enough. They were done as a substitute for hand-waving in budget talks, McQuarrie said modestly of his paintings. Little could he know how effective a stand-in they would be. The concept paintings helped clear up some of the confusion over Lucas's vision, but there was one more complicating factor. Lucas's second draft was embarrassingly crowded with men. He'd already gotten a lot of heat over the fact that graffiti ended with on-screen text, catching us up with the next 10 years in the lives of the male characters, and nothing about the women. With the feminist movement growing more powerful with each passing month, Star Wars seemed on track for similar criticism. In March 1975, Lucas decided to fix that at a stroke. Luke Starkiller became an 18-year-old woman. After all, he'd been reading an awful lot of fairy tales as research into the mechanics of storytelling, and it's rather hard to ignore the convention that the protagonist of fairy tales is almost always female. Think Cinderella, Rapunzel, Snow White, Red Riding Hood, and Goldilocks. As much as they have to be saved by princes or woodcutters, we at least see the story through their eyes. This gender reversal lasted for a couple of months, long enough for the female Luke to show up in a Macquarie painting of the main characters. By May 1975, when Lucas wrote a crucial 6-page synopsis for Fox executives, a synopsis not of the second draft, but of an entirely new story, Luke was back to being a boy. But Princess Leia had returned from the purgatory of the first draft, and in a much more prominent role. Now she was a leader of the rebellion from the outset, replacing Deke Starkiller in the opening scene and in the prison on Alderaan. That latter part meant that she would be rather visibly tortured by Vader. It would take Lucas one more draft to develop a distaste for putting a bruised and battered woman in his movie. The Starkiller himself was absent in the synopsis. Now, it turned out, he had been killed in battle many years ago. Instead, Luke is mentored by an old general named Ben Kenobi, who has become a hermit on Luke's home planet. Armed with these new characters, Lucas threw himself into a third draft. His writing process began to accelerate. A year had elapsed between the treatment and the first draft. The second had taken him 9 months. Lucas wrote the third draft in 7 months. It was slightly shorter than the second, at roughly 27,000 words. If you go through it and delete any scene or dialogue that was not ultimately filmed, what's left is about 17,000 words. That meant Lucas had the majority of Star Wars in his hands by August 1975. The third draft still opened with that Journal of the Wills quote about the Son of Sons. It was too clever a line for Lucas to let go. The roll-up was still way too long, but a key change had happened in the dialogue. There was less of it. Lucas, the editor, had taken the reins. Where previously he had burbled on for paragraphs, 3PO now opens the movie with 4 short sentences, the first of numerous lines from this draft that would make it into the final film. "Did you hear that? They've shut down the main reactor. We'll be destroyed for sure. This is madness." The number of special effects called for in the script had been edited down, too. Lucas was mindful of the budget and more realistic about costs. At some point during the scriptwriting process, Fox shuttered its entire special effects department. Indeed, of the major studios, only Universal had a special effects department left. So Lucas and Kurtz hired their own special effects guy, the brilliant and difficult John Dykstra. Dykstra was a protege of 2001 and silent-running spaceship guru Doug Trumbull, who was Lucas's first choice and suggested Dykstra. In an industrial park in the C.D. Van Nuys district of Los Angeles, Dykstra began assembling a young team eager to work long hours for little pay, $20,000 a year on average, in return for the chance to get some incredibly real-looking spaceships up on the screen. Lucas gave the group an appropriately awesome name, Industrial Light and Magic. As cheap as they were, however, in total, they were already costing the director $25,000 a week out of his own pocket. No wonder, he reasoned, that one terrifyingly large Imperial Star Destroyer could be just as effective in the opening chase sequence as 4. The third draft cuts from the space battle to the surface of the planet below, where Luke Starkiller is trying to persuade his friends he saw 2 ships through his electro-binoculars, exchanging laser fire. Of course, the battle is over before they get to see it. One of his friends, Biggs Darklighter, has just returned from the Imperial Academy and confides to Luke in hushed tones that he's going to jump ship and join the rebellion. The Ashland Force is gone in the new draft. But Lucas clung to the name of the evil Bogan Force, eager to have us understand it. Like, Bogan weather or Bogan times, Luke says when he learns about it from Ben Kenobi. I thought that was just a saying. The Bogan only crops up 8 times in this draft, however. There is still a scene in which a grizzled veteran slams his arm down in sorrow to reveal he is part cyborg. This role had now passed from Kane to Montross to Kenobi. The old Jedi general, whom Luke has studied, he knows his Diary of the Clone Wars by heart, is much more of a reluctant warrior than he would ultimately become. Luke has to drag him out to adventure into the galaxy, rather than the other way around. Ben Kenobi really is getting too old for this sort of thing. Still, Kenobi brings with him a new element to the script. Comedy. Luke is attacked by Tusken Raiders just before he meets Ben. They leave him handcuffed to a giant spinning wheel. Kenobi approaches with a, "Good morning." "What do you mean, good morning?" Luke responds. "Do you mean that it is a good morning for you, or do you wish me a good morning, although it is obvious I'm not having one, or do you find that mornings in general are good?" "All of them at once," replies Kenobi. It's a great laugh line. It is also lifted word for word from The Hobbit. J.R.R. Tolkien's work was so widely read by the 1970s that Lucas could never have gotten away with the theft. It vanishes in the fourth draft. Still, it does reveal Obi-Wan Kenobi's origins, as well as Yoda's, rather plainly. This version of Kenobi is the acknowledged father of both of them, and he's a giggling galactic Gandalf. Tolkien had died in 1973, just as Lucas was getting started on the first draft, and Middle-earth books had never been more popular. There was a surprising amount of overlap between the third draft of Star Wars and Tolkien's trilogy, The Lord of the Rings. Both are full of strange creatures burbling meticulously made-up languages. R2 and 3PO are Frodo and Sam. The innocents abroad, whether they're carrying the stolen data tapes or the One Ring. Both pairs of innocents are guided and guarded by ensemble casts. The Death Star, the hellish war machine, is Mordor. Stormtroopers are orcs. Grand Moff Tarkin, now on the side of evil, is a dead ringer for Saruman. Darth Vader, the Dark Lord of the Sith, is Sauron, Dark Lord of Mordor. Gandalf, Kenobi, carries a magic sword and eventually sacrifices himself only to return in slightly altered and more magical form. There was another book that loomed large in Lucas's mind at the time, and that he would often bring up in later interviews. Carlos Castaneda's Tales of Power, part of Castaneda's supposedly autobiographical series about the revealing philosophical trials he went through to gain sorcerer-like powers. The relationship between Luke and Ben would come to echo that of Castaneda and the Yaqui mystic Don Juan. We're a long, long way from Flash Gordon now. We've mixed space fantasy with classic or high fantasy, added a layer of mysticism, and sprinkled on a few jokes and comic characters. Then there was just the right pinch of something else. Backstory. Luke's allusion to Ben Kenobi's Diary of the Clone Wars in the third draft is the first mention of a conflict that would become a major part of Star Wars lore. It was around this time that Lucas began writing notes on the backstory of his universe. Not much more than 7 or 8 pages of notes, by Lucas's reckoning, by the time the next draft, the fourth, came around. But it was enough to give him the confidence to throw in 2 references to the Clone Wars, one from Luke, the other in Princess Leia's hologram message. We learn that Kenobi served Leia's father during them. We get the picture. The Clone Wars were World War II to this current Vietnam-like guerrilla action against the Empire, which, in the third draft, Luke calls the Counter Wars. Lucas would guard the Clone Wars details more jealously than any other plot point. In years to come, they would be off-limits even to Lucasfilm's licensed writers. We would not find out who the clones were or on whose side they had fought for nearly 3 decades, during which time a million imaginary versions of the conflict would play out in a million minds. Chewbacca comes to the fore in the third draft as well. Ralph McQuarrie's sketches of the creature, based on an image Lucas had provided him from a science fiction story magazine, McQuarrie added the bandolier, seemed to bring him into sharper relief in Lucas's mind. There was another influence in front of Lucas's face every day, of course. Wookiees may have gotten their species name from Bill Wookie, and Lucas may have been thinking about Wookiees ever since he chatted about them on the graffiti set. But Chewbacca, in particular, and the notion of him as Solo's co-pilot, came from the enormous Lucas dog, Indiana, strapped into the front seat of Marsh's car. Lucas was so enamored with Wookiees by the filming stage that, according to Mark Hamill, he once flirted with the idea of adding a Journal of the Wills-like framing device to the movie, one in which the whole narrative is a story being told by a mother Wookiee to her baby. Then there is Han Solo, who in the third draft has become a full-fledged pirate rather than a cabin boy. He is ever more like Coppola, a suave huckster who can talk his way into anything, a foil to Lucas's Luke. As Lucas tore through the third draft in mid-1975, Coppola was much on Lucas's mind. Coppola was at that point pressing his protege to put his space fantasy hobby movie on the back burner and direct the hard-hitting Vietnam film he'd long talked about, Apocalypse Now. After The Godfather Part II, Coppola could afford to write his own ticket. He wanted to be the producer and to whisk Lucas off to the Philippines pronto. To Lucas's friends, this seemed like the smart move. Lucas was, after all, an independent movie guy. It was his turn to make a big statement, something dark and gritty. His Chinatown, his Taxi Driver. Kurtz had spent more time scouting for Apocalypse than he had for Star Wars. Lucas had been planning for the Vietnam movie for 4 years and writing Star Wars for just 2. The last American helicopters had left the rooftops of Saigon on April 30, 1975, just as Lucas was between his second and third Star Wars drafts. If he made Apocalypse Now, Lucas could help write the first draft of the conflict's history. It would have been so easy to postpone the pain of Star Wars. One word to Coppola would have done it. There was still no agreement with Fox on the budget. In fact, Fox put the project on a moratorium in October, pending a December meeting of the whole board. Laddie was still a strong supporter, but even he was nervous about spending more than $7 million on the project. The chance of Star Wars being made had never seemed more remote. So what stopped Lucas from walking away? Why did he beg Coppola to wait and then finally, in frustration, tell him to go make Apocalypse Now himself? To hear Lucas tell it, it was all about the kids. He'd been getting letters from teen fans about American Graffiti. They had been into drugs. Then they saw his movie, jumped in their cars, chased girls. It was pretty much all guys who wrote to Lucas, and it really straightened some of them out, Lucas reported. That led him to wonder what a good old-fashioned adventure movie could do for younger kids who at that point had nothing to watch but Kojak and the $6 Million Man and what Lucas called movies of insecurity. Kids like Coppola's sons, 10-year-old Roman and 12-year-old Giancarlo. Lucas talked to them about the Star Wars. They got it when the grown-ups didn't. Roman would later become the first official member of the Star Wars fan club. But Lucas was also in too deep to quit now. He hadn't been sweating blood over the Apocalypse script like this. Apocalypse was John Milius's writing obsession. Lucas's interest in Flash Gordon preceded his interest in Vietnam. True, his vision of what Apocalypse Now should be was completely different from Coppola's. The George Lucas version would be more man against machine than anything else, he said in 1977. Technology against humanity, and then how humanity won. It was to have been quite a positive vision, but it did not escape his attention that he was dealing with every one of those themes already in Star Wars, albeit in more shrouded allegorical form. Besides, Lucas had just come across a fascinating book about telling stories through allegory, one written in 1949. He had digested hundreds of fairy tales by 1975, as he attempted to boil down some basic story elements for the Star Wars script, and this book jibed with a lot of things he'd been doing in picking apart story and myth and religious ritual. It was the Golden Bough as a user's manual. The author claimed that all tales could be boiled down to a single story with a defined arc. Borrowing a term from James Joyce, he called it the monomyth. The book was The Hero with a Thousand Faces. The author was Joseph Campbell. The influence of Campbell's book on the original Star Wars has been overstated. It was far more influential in the drafting of the next two films. Kurtz eschews the influence of the book and the whole idea of Star Wars as a mythological thing because all coming-of-age stories fit that model, and Hollywood has done those kinds of stories since the beginning. He points out that the Campbell connection wasn't mentioned in interviews until after Lucas met the author in 1983. But Campbell's book did help Lucas tighten up his plot and may have encouraged him to make the first film's fairy tale connection more plain. As 1975 drew to a close, Lucas decided he wasn't writing an interstellar Bible story anymore. He cut the Son of Sons line from the opening. In its place, he added, "A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, an amazing adventure took place." In the end, Lucas was simply guided by everything he liked. "Star Wars is a sort of compilation," he would tell an interviewer, "but it's never been put in one story before, never been put down on film. There is a lot taken from westerns, mythology, and samurai movies. It's all the things that are great put together. It's not like one kind of ice cream, but rather a very big sundae." On January 1, 1976, Lucas finished the fourth draft. Barring one more minor revision, a good chunk of witty dialogue rewrites from Willard Hike and Gloria Katz, and some cut scenes, this version is pretty much what audiences saw the following year. On December 13th, the Fox board had finally, officially, agreed to a budget of $8.3 million. Another vital piece of good luck, 2001 was re-released in 1975. And the movie finally broke even the same month the Fox board met. "We wouldn't have made Star Wars without the success of 2001, says Charlie Lippincott, the movie's marketing guru. Another odd fact, Star Wars might never have been funded without the consent, or at least the consenting silence of Grace Kelly. The Monaco Princess had been named to the Fox board in July 1975. Ostensibly to get away from her oppressive husband and back to Hollywood as often as possible. "She was fairly quiet about the whole thing," Laddie said when I asked him if he remembered the late princess's take on this tale of a galactic princess. "I didn't feel she was really that fond of it, but don't remember her saying anything negative." On a board that was bitterly divided over the movie Laddie had greenlit, her silence may have been enough to tilt the scales in favor of funding it. In any case, she got her reward in January 1978, when a rigged lottery gave Princess Grace and her children the very first pre-production set of Star Wars action figures. Thus far, Lucas had spent $473,000 of his own money on the Star Wars. He knew this dessert would take far more ingredients than could be bought for $8.3 million. That was a fairly low figure. The average studio comedy at the time, with no special effects, cost around $20 million. How on earth could Lucas realize his vision on that budget? He cut the Alderaan prison scene from the script, placing that whole sequence aboard the Death Star, purely to save money. Instead, he had the Death Star destroy Alderaan from a distance as a demonstration of its power. To us, in hindsight, it may seem like a natural fix. Back then, it seemed more like having to take the banana out of the sundae. Still, it was almost time to serve it up. 9. Spoof Wars. We tend to go overboard with hindsight when examining the history of something successful. We build creation myths out of the creation of a myth. The creator himself, seeking a simple solution to the questions he must answer over and over, is often more than happy to help in this deception. But Star Wars was not made in a heavenly moment with the muses. It did not arrive on stone tablets. It was far more of a light, wispy thing. As tempting as it is to think of the entire franchise as some preordained feat of genius, it's far more revealing to view it as Flash Gordon fanfiction meets fairy tale, made by a film nerd who, suddenly finding himself with a lot of time and money on his hands, was experimenting more than anything else. "He acts now like he knew it was going to be a big hit," says Charlie Lippincott. "He didn't. He was just farting around." When did Lucas hit on the right formula? When he added a sense of humor to the stodgy old space fantasy mixture. The jokes started to creep into the third draft, with its giggling Ben Kenobi, and really piled on in the fourth, with a little help from his friends. If you listen to the way Lucas talks about Star Wars, beyond responding to our loaded questions about myth and legend, there's a distinct sense of levity to his answers. Back in early post-Star Wars interviews, he would talk about this strong sense of effervescent giddiness he'd detected in rewatching American Graffiti and Star Wars back to back. He felt the movies were of a piece. Later on, he would half-joke that he wrote Star Wars to give Mad Magazine material. I've heard more than one fan express this notion. "George Lucas is trolling us all." In 2010, on stage with his preferred interviewer, Jon Stewart, we saw the goofy way Lucas likes to play with the franchise, even now. Stewart asked a question that had bugged him for years. On what planet was Obi-Wan Kenobi born? "This is one of the first things I wrote in the very first script," Lucas said. "Really?" responded Stewart. "You're not just making this up." "No, I wouldn't do that. He comes from the planet Stujon." Lucas was joking and serious at once. The serious part came when Lucasfilm confirmed that, yes, the planet of Stujon, home of Obi-Wan Kenobi, had now been added to the official Star Wars Galactic Atlas. Previously printed works that claimed Kenobi had been born on the planet of Coruscant, the galactic imperial capital, were no longer accurate. The creator had spoken. And this wasn't even the first time the creator had jokingly changed Star Wars canon on the fly to flatter a late-night talk show host. Chatting with Conan O'Brien in 2007, Lucas claimed that the full name of Death Star Admiral Mahdi, the first imperial to be force-choked by Darth Vader, was Conan Antonio Mahdi. The writer of the Lucasfilm novel Death Star, who had decided to give Mahdi the first name Z in the book, had to scramble to change it. Should Star Wars, then, be classified as a comedy? Certainly one of the film's three lead actors thought so. "I laughed all through Star Wars," said Mark Hamill. "I thought they were comedies. It was absurd having a big giant dog flying your spaceship, and this kid from the farm is wacko for this princess he's never met, that he's seen in a hologram. The robots are arguing over whose fault it is. They hook up with a magic wizard and they borrow a ship from a pirate. It was goofier than hell." No wonder Hamill would play Luke Skywalker just as fervently during his guest appearance on The Muppet Show as in the movies. For him, it was practically one and the same. Of course, Hamill and his compadres played this humor deadpan, just the way Lucas does with his jokes. The movie was performed in earnest. There was to be no winking to the audience. Viewers might laugh, but they'd also be immersed in the galaxy Lucas had created. Come for the comedy, stay for the world-building. In a sense, Lucas and company have been performing an elaborate galactic-sized improv for decades, with participation from a massive troupe of improv artists. That explains why Star Wars has attracted more than its share of spoofs, skits, and whimsical fan-made ephemera over the years. And why those spoofs have almost all taken a surprisingly reverential approach to the source material. It seems everyone wanted in on the exact same joke Lucas was telling in the first place, laughing along with him rather than at him. Take stormtroopers, who managed to look simultaneously badass and ridiculous. As seriously as the 501st takes its costume accuracy, it can't resist spoofing the stormtroopers by holding, for example, Hawaiian shirt contests. "That's a powerful aspect of comedy, debasing authority figures," says Alvin Johnson. "They're modern-day tin soldiers." One of the most recent case studies of this planet-wide improv act is the Death Star White House petition. Here's how that got started. In January 2012, a student at the University of Leicester in England was watching Return of the Jedi when a question popped into his head about Star Destroyers. These sleek triangular battleships of the Galactic Empire are seen on screen at the beginning of every movie in the original Star Wars trilogy. Most of us look at them and think, wow. Sean Goodwin looked at them and thought, how much steel would it take to build those? Is there enough iron in the earth to construct one? The question wasn't entirely idle. Sean had an old boarding school friend in the United States, Anjan Gupta, an Indian-born economics student at Lehigh University, who was making a name for himself writing an economics blog for his class called Centives. In its first year, Centives' greatest scoop was proving that it was cheaper to pay for the buffet in the dining hall than to go on the meal plan, which irked the administration and won the blog a few hundred admirers. Then Anjan, on a whim after reading the Harry Potter books, had decided to calculate the cost of everything you'd need to go to Hogwarts School for Wizards. The resulting blog post went viral, getting picked up on CNN and The Daily Show, and garnering more than 10 million page views. It had been hard to go back to college-level blogging after that, so Anjan had enlisted Sean to help write more quirky pop culture economics entries. Sean's first post, a calculation of how many zombies it would take to overthrow history's greatest armies, had seen little interest. Maybe Star Destroyers would do better. Or better yet, how about the largest piece of battle technology in the Star Wars universe, the planet-killing Death Star itself? Because if you're going to ask for the impossible, let's find the most ridiculously impossible thing, laughs Sean. Goodwin decided to focus on the original Death Star, also known as DS-1, whose dimension was easier to calculate than that of the filigree half-finished but fully operational version in Return of the Jedi. A quick Google search later, Wikipedia gave him the diameter of DS-1, 160 kilometers, or roughly one-tenth the size of Earth's moon. Instead of spending weeks trying to estimate how many floors, hangars, elevators, ventilation shafts, and garbage mashers were in the DS-1, as a hardcore fan might, Sean simply assumed the steel distribution would be roughly similar to that of an aircraft carrier, because they're both essentially floating weapons platforms. So all Sean had to do was get a number for the amount of steel in an average-sized aircraft carrier and calculate the number of aircraft carriers that could fit inside the Death Star. Barely an hour later, he had his number. The Death Star contains 1 quadrillion tons, metric tons, of steel. There was, Sean discovered, more than enough iron in the Earth's core to construct 2 million Death Stars. Assuming you could find a way to siphon it out, however, turning it into steel would take 833,315 years at the current rate of production. That, Sean reasoned, wouldn't make for a particularly interesting article. The Death Star can be built. Sort of. Almost as an afterthought, he wondered, how much would it cost? The answer, for the steel alone, was $852 quadrillion, or 13,000% of global GDP. He wrote that at the bottom and emailed the entry to Anjan. Anjan loved the dollar amount so much, he made it the headline. We sat back and said, well, that's a really big number. We don't need anything else, says Sean. Let's just put that on the internet and see what happens. At first, nothing happened. On its first day, the article got a few hundred readers and one comment. Awesome! On day two came the question, when do we get started? Day three saw queries about the cost of copper for all the electronics, an offer of a wheelbarrow as seed capital, and an estimate of staffing requirements based on the same scale, 34 trillion crew members. But the article wasn't taking off in the same way the Harry Potter one had, and Anjan felt bad for telling Sean the Death Star post was going to go viral. Sean's response was legendary. I cannot conceive of a world where people would not want to know this. Then a popular economics blog, Marginal Revolution, picked the story up and got its readers chattering. An Australian newspaper reprinted it. Tech blogs started to take notice. Forbes added its own analysis, pointing out that you had to take into account the entire galactic GDP, not just that of one measly planet. Mother Jones quibbled over the cost of steel, putting it closer to 1.3 million times global GDP. By June, Paul Krugman was talking to Wired about just how much financial sense it made to build an $852 quadrillion Death Star. Traffic to Centives exploded.